Miss Desmond. Miss Desmond. It's me. It's Hawkeye.
Hello, Hawkeye.
Let's get a good look at you.
Look, there's Norma Desmond.
Norma Desmond.
The movie speaks.
This is not a drill. This is not a fake out. We are back. Hello. Let
and
the movie speak.
Better
listeners.
Than ever.
What? I'm sorry. Did you want to speak on the podcast, Justin?
No, not really. Okay. Go ahead. This is your rodeo now.
I had a 7-minute monologue prepared. So if you could just
oh, okay.
Strap in.
I'll just take a seat here and listen. Thank
no,
you.
We are super excited to be back in the studio, as it were. Justin's giggling for reasons. But yeah, we're if you last tuned in and you were listening to a time travel series, well, this was all part of the plan. We were going to travel forward in time and skip a couple episodes of that series for reasons technical that aren't that interesting, and jump right into the 1950s and get back into the swing of things, talking about this decade. Justin, how are you? It's been a while.
It has been a while, my friend. Thanks for asking. Doing good. Very excited to be back and to have the opportunity to do this again, and maybe for the 500 or anywhere in between people that actually have been kind enough to listen to this. I feel like we owe them a little bit of an explanation about just what the heck happened. Why were we gone? Where did the rest of the time travel promised fruit go?
Yeah.
And what brought us to this point?
Well, I think we can start with the wormhole, right? I mean, a wormhole
right.
opened up and
yep.
we
you
fell
crawled
inside.
Through first.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm...
Yeah, fell inside. Come on, you're like, that's a wormhole. I've always wanted to. And
well,
I'm like, no.
I'm the brave one, so...
yeah, well, I grabbed onto your Nike,
yep.
kind of, but you were already slipping and sliding, and one sweaty foot later, we were there.
We were, where were we, though? That's the real question.
We suddenly ended up in an alternative dimensionoid, and unfortunately,
that's good. That was multiverses are hot right now. Keep it going. That's good.
Yeah. I'm trying to, just tap into the cultural milieu here.
Nice.
And unfortunately, in this dimension, we didn't find any superheroes. We just found some thieves that broke in and took all of our podcasting equipment.
Yeah. And if all of this sounded like nonsense, it's because most of it was, except for that last part. we've had a lot of stuff happen, like a move, and I've moved recording locations, and in betwixt all of the moving and delays, and some technical delays too, literally all of our podcast equipment was absconded with. It's just, it was gone one day.
But this is probably a perfect opportunity to put up our podcasting reward offered sign.
Yes.
If you see any of Let the Movie Speak marked podcasting equipment
yes.
at your local pawn shop, Craigslist, black market, we're offering a $5.75 reward.
That's what's in the account from the sponsored Anchor ads so far.
Right. Yeah, that's what we've got to work with. We're willing to give 100% of the proceeds we have made from this show.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just was the equipment stolen, but we had several episodes.
Three episodes.
So that was a bummer.
Ready to go. And they were... They were three episodes, one of which we're redoing at this very moment. So it's been a long road, Justin. A long and winding road back to The 50s.
This.
Yeah.
The 50s.
Whatever this is, which is the 50s.
So, yeah, we may be a little less fresh coming into this specific movie, but we are excited to, we're thankful we at least have, we have equipment, we have space to do this now.
Yes.
So if you are kind enough to subscribe to this, rate us or listen at all, thank you.
Yes,
because that's why we're doing it. We don't enjoy really. I don't think either of us really enjoys hearing ourselves talk. We're doing this for the greater good of mankind, is what I'm getting at. This is our service to humanity.
Yeah, yeah. Just go back and listen to the Somewhere in Time episode. That's for the greater good of mankind. Oh gosh. We do it because we enjoy it, and because hopefully some good comes out of it. And so we're happy to be back in the saddle, putting on our podcast pants once again. And we're going to be into the 1950s, just like if you've listened in the past, we did all of the 30s. Not all of the 30s. We did a selection of films.
Every single movie from the 30s.
It took 7 years. It's
a very long season.
And then we did the 40s. We did a couple series in between. And we're gonna hit the 50s, and we got a good list of movies coming up. We've got a kind of an extended list, because once you get into like the 50s and beyond, Justin, like it's hard. It's hard to pick like 8 or 10, man.
I feel like that's because, you know, and we're seeing this on steroids today now in the 2020s, but the process of filmmaking just got more and more democratic as you know, it got out of the control of just a couple huge studios.
Yes.
It got out of control of just America, really, and a couple of like French and English guys playing around with cameras.
Yeah.
By the time we get to the 50s and 60s, now we're seeing cinema from India, from Africa, from China. And, you know, these are all places that may have had some kind of film scene before that time. But it's like, you know, it's finally matured enough in those places where some real enduring art that I think is worth talking about even to this day still stands. So
for sure.
Yeah, I struggle with it too, man. There is so much good to take out every decade, and our top 10 or 8 or 12 or whatever we pick for a season should in no way indicate that's like the top 10 movies of the decade or anything like that.
No, just I think our track 10 record proves otherwise. Yeah. Not to mention, like, while all that was happening, right, while the access was starting to really ramp up for like international like films, the American studios were going like exponentially crazier because people were back from, you know, it's the 50s, right? The American dream is being born on screen, and like, so those studios are pumping out blockbuster after blockbuster and genre flicks and you know, prestige pictures. It's just like, it's just more, because this medium that was once a little bit more niche, maybe a little bit more inaccessible, and certainly the supply and the demand weren't kind of aligned in the same way. Like, there's just so many movies. There's just so many. So,
and what's great about that is, I mean, people may shudder at this thought, but it would give us opportunity. Just there's a limitless amount of these seasons we could do.
Oh, really. Yeah.
I think even if we lived to 500 years old, we could still be doing, you know, even if we just limited it to like the decades, 10 episodes a decade.
We could just go round and round. Yeah.
You would never stop. There's so much good out of every decade. So,
and for every film we pick and it ends up in the series, there's at least one that we have to cut off and say goodbye to.
Absolutely.
You know? So bringing up studios is a really keen observation, Justin, because the movie we're talking about today has a lot to do with studios and the Hollywood system. And
yes, it does.
Movies being made. It's like got to be one of the first like ultra meta movies, right? Like to hit screens.
Yeah.
And it is 1950s Sunset Boulevard. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. But before we do, we're going to do as we always do and haven't done in a while, talk about what we watched this week. So, Justin, Have you ever seen a comic book movie?
Comic books. Let me think about. You know, it sounds familiar. I'm sure I've seen a couple, or maybe. Yeah. Why do you ask?
There. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
There's this one comic book movie from days gone by. Before comic book movies were really in vogue. In fact, this even predates Spider-Man, like the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man. It's called X-Men, and I happened to rewatch it a couple days ago. And here's what I found interesting.
Okay.
What I really like about this movie is that it comes from an era before the blockbuster was synonymous with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and there's an expectation for these films to be massive hits and to kind of push everybody's buttons, like, you know, the fan servicey buttons and the lore buttons and the sequelitis buttons and the stinger, all of that. And so what I think this movie does really well is it embraces the inherent, like, silliness of the source material, right? Like, there's grounded stuff and there's good performances, and then there's just, like, the kind of jokiness that I feel like works much better than the typical Marvel joke might land for me today. So, like, the things that it does well are it embraces some of the otherworldly kind of silliness that's just, like, it's there. You can either ignore it and be overly serious and get something maybe like Captain America, the Winter Soldier, or you can, like, go head first into it and not really take any of your characters seriously, like maybe like Thor Ragnarok, you know, in my opinion, or something like that. And what this does really well is it, like, the stuff in the story matters, but then, like, there's lines like, oh, he puts the suit on for the first time and zips it up and says, you guys go outside in these things. And he's like, well, what would you prefer, yellow spandex? Right? Like, that, to me, is the right timber of, we know what we are, and we're going to, like, make a nice popcorn movie. But also, like, it's not, like, we're not taking ourselves so seriously all the time.
Right.
And then, of course, there's terrible things in this movie. Like, it's the third act has some really goopy CGI stuff. And then the classic line of dialogue. Do you know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning? The same thing that happens to everything else.
That was an inspired line, my friend. Bill Shakespeare said it first.
Yeah. Bill Shakespeare. There's a couple accents in this movie that come and go completely at random. But Patrick Stewart is kind of awesome, and Ian McKellen is kind of awesome. That's predictable. And, and I honestly believe, having watched enough of his movies, that Hugh Jackman as Wolverine is one of those roles that won't ever be recast properly. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, yeah, totally, you can recast.
It's a Harrison Ford thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It is a Harrison Ford thing. Like, he just, not only was he in so many of them that it's hard to divorce that character from the actor, but he committed so hard to everything about the performance, you know, the emotional beats, the physicality. Everything about it is so well realized as an adaptation of a comic book character that, like, I know there's, like, rumblings of certain people who might take that over soon, and I'm just like, I don't think that's gonna work. I just can't. I cannot see it. So, any thoughts on the original X-Men, Justin?
Yeah, well, I remember watching it in the old theater, kind of on a sort of nostalgic note. It kind of makes me a little sad when, because in that third act you're talking about, there's a whole set piece on the Statue of Liberty.
Yes.
And this was filmed and released pre-9/11, so that was still, like, you could still go inside the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
You know, at that time. So it's just kind of it's an interesting cultural, you know, touchstone in that sense, I think, even in a small way, just to a time that doesn't exist anymore, which is probably as serious of a commentary you can make for a movie like this.
Sure.
I do agree with you that it's... It is goofy in kind of the best sense, and it was really successful when it came out. And I remember, I think even our friend Roger Ebert had some nice things to say about it.
Yeah,
and it was because it wasn't just, like, overly, I don't know of a kind. I'm sure there's a kinder word, so don't hold it against me, listeners. But it wasn't overly stupid.
Yeah.
You know, but it also wasn't Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight. Serious,
sure, sure.
You know, which it shouldn't be. If one of your characters is called Toad and he hops around like a toad and his tongue comes out like a toad, you know,
which it does, yes.
And I do think it's interesting that, you know, you go ahead and look at Hugh Jackman. He's got a few shirtless scenes in this movie, as he does in all the other X-Men movies too, which is, you know, hey, that's part of the, you're paying the ticket for that too, right? But go ahead and compare his physique. Where he's still in shape. He's never like a lard bucket or something.
That'd be
right?
Great.
He's always looking like a dude that has worked out.
Yeah.
But go ahead, if you're interested, go ahead and compare like a still of Hugh Jackman without a shirt from X-Men 1.
Yeah.
And then go ahead and look at a still from the Wolverine or from Logan.
Yeah.
And then try to tell me that steroids don't happen in Hollywood. that's the other, like, yeah. I mean, it's probably better to laugh at that, honestly, because you could take that down a more serious path. But it is just, if we can take a second, it's just really absurd that, I'm sure they sign like NDAs or something when they're signing their contracts, right? But I get a little tired of like, wow, Chris Hemsworth, you got really in shape for this movie. How'd you do it? Oh, just chicken and rice. It's like, no, chicken and rice and lifting dumbbells does not do that. I mean, it'll do a lot for you, but it does not grow your head size.
Yeah, it won't put six veins on the bridge of your nose.
So it's just, it's a little silly, you know, because I agree with you, Travis, that superhero-itis, you called, you know, sequel-itis, I think there's also superhero-itis where it's just like, oh my gosh, that's all we can do now. And it does make money. I mean, that's why we're doing it, right? Because there's an audience for it.
Yep.
There's a market for it. But, I mean, if Hollywood has shown us anything, including kind of this movie today, Sunset Boulevard we're talking about, it's that you can't, there is a limit. You can bleed stuff dry, like we did with the Westerns. We started with that in the 30s, and then by the 60s, everyone went, stop, please.
No more Westerns.
And then, little known fact, that's actually what caused the inflation in the 70s.
Yeah, that's
it
what did
nothing
it.
Nothing to do with, it was Westerns.
The gas shortage was specifically tied to horse trailers trying to get those horses out to the movie sets. That's where all the gas went.
And here we are, Travis, in 2022. We've got inflation again. Guys, it's not Biden's I did that stickers. I'll tell you what. Put Kevin Feige's sticker on there. No, I did that.
They blew up too many helicarriers with gasoline. Do the math, people. Yes.
Do the math. Are you blind? Alex Jones has more coming up on that later. I enjoy the first X-Men, and you know, if superhero movies could take a little break for a little while, I'd be really okay with that. Not to say that there's not good stuff occasionally in some of them still, and some super talented people involved. But you'd be hard pressed, in my opinion, to make a genuine argument that these things are anything less than formulaic popcorn ticket punchers. And you know what? That's okay to have popcorn movies and entertainment. Not everything needs to be like Wes Anderson or, you know, Goddard or, you know.
Sure.
That's okay. But can we just admit that's what it is? You know,
yeah.
And like, I just really like superhero movies because my childhood was holed up in my room with comic books. Hey, that's great. But like, you know, I think our contention maybe, Travis, is that it's got such a stranglehold on just like that's where all the money is going.
It's
right
the box
now.
Office, yeah.
That is the box office, yeah. Right? Which just like by comparison, look at Top Gun Maverick just came out as of recording of this, just a few weeks, almost a month ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, 86, right? When the first one came out, that was a blockbuster in the traditional sense. And now, you know, the one today, I think it's done really well, and it has gotten really good reviews, too. People seem to like it. I haven't seen it yet, so I can't comment on that. But it's kind of like a drop in the bucket, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of, like, coverage and people talking about it. It's just like superheroes have, you know, it's interesting that people do not seem that interested on a general scale in just like, you know, I'm about to call Top Gun original. Isn't that a little sad?
Well, the thing about the new Top Gun is it's like, just to clear the deck here, I have negative interest in seeing that movie, But right. from the buzz that I've heard, it's like, this is so much better than the original, and it's nothing like it. It's basically in name only. Like, it's called Top Gun. It has jets, and it has Tom Cruise. But other than that,
right.
this is just a different, better movie. And
yeah.
that's funny if you think about it on its own. It's like, IP right. is such a rudder for everything nowadays.
Yes.
That, like, yeah. we have to slap the name Top Gun on it. We got to get Tom Cruise to be in it and do all his own stunts. Yeah. But, like, can we not make a pile of crap? Like, because Top Gun stinks. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, guys.
It's really bad.
It's a bad movie.
Reed Ebert's review. He says it the best.
Yes, as he often does. Okay, Justin. We yeah. already told the people. We already talked about this movie, but we're going to do it again. And
we're going to have a good attitude about it.
Yeah, we're going to, like I said, pull on those podcast pants one leg at a time and
a little tighter. Mm, yeah. Awkward.
Well, you're going to have to get out there and do some jumping jacks.
It's the ankles.
The cankles.
I have pulmonary edema.
I shouldn't be laughing at that. Okay, we're talking about Sunset Boulevard. This is a, let's just say at the top, this movie kind of rules. It's very, very good.
Yes.
It has a lot of really interesting things to say. So we're not going to be lacking in good, like, thematic conversation here. But just to contextualize things, the log line reads, a screenwriter develops a dangerous relationship with a faded film star determined to make a triumphant return. This is a film directed by Billy Wilder. Written by Charles Brackett and Billy Wilder, as well as D.M. Marshman Jr. It stars William Holden as the principal lead, Joe Gillis, and then Gloria Swanson as Norma Desmond, and a bunch of good B characters in here to fill out the cast. The main thing you need to know about Sunset Boulevard, and we kind of hinted at this, is that when we say meta, basically it's like it's a movie about movies, but it's also much more specifically like meta commentary, because Norma Desmond was a silent film actress, and Norma Desmond did fade into obscurity. And this was the movie, in fact, that brought her back to the big screen after a long while. And then it was hugely admired and brought acclaim and tons of Oscar nominations. So the main thread in here that's really interesting is there's people in the story that are connected to the story being told in real life.
Right.
So it plays on a level that is really interesting, not to mention the whole thing exists, Justin, to give sort of to air the grievances of the studio systems, you know, where it can go wrong, where it can be anti-art in a lot of ways, right? And sort of chew people up and spit them out. So one of the main things to note here about this film's legacy and the way it's been received is it got nominated for a bunch of stuff. It got nominated for picture, editing, cinematography, director, supporting actress, actor, lead actress, actor, and it won score, art direction for black and white, and screenplay. So, I mean, Justin, before we watched this, what was your kind of relationship with the movie? How did you know it?
My mom is a great big classic movie fan.
She's ginormous.
She's one of those. My mother's actually.
She's tiny, actually.
Yeah. Smaller lady. Smaller. But she is big in heart when it comes to having affection.
She has an enlarged heart. We need to get her to the hospital.
Yeah, we are taking care of her.
I'm sorry.
No, she loves classic movies, silent movies, just anything from the golden age of Hollywood. And so this was a movie we had growing up because she wanted to have a copy of it. And so it was one that she showed to me. And one I think that she still catches whenever it's on TCM.
Yeah.
So I definitely was familiar with the movie and was really intrigued because there are some There are some scenes in here and some clips that you have probably seen on every, like when MGM used to do back in the archaic days of DVDs.
Yeah, yeah.
When they would do sort of like these mini, not even a trailer, just kind of like showcasing MGM highlights, you know, through the ages. And so there'd be a clip from this movie and that movie. And invariably, you'd always get, you know, the last line in this movie. I'm ready for my close-up now, Mr. DeMille.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think for a lot of people, maybe they're familiar with it just on those terms, even if they don't know, like, what movie that is.
Yeah.
They're familiar with it because clips, I think that's probably the largest one, or the one that's most used. But, you know, in this, although that is amazing, and I understand why it lends itself to, you know, being a 5-second clip, I would say the rest of this whole movie is a powerhouse. Everything here works. And you'd mentioned it being meta, and now watching it, you know, that was not what I was thinking when I was like 13 or whatever.
Sure.
And watched this for the first time. But yeah, watching it now, it definitely fits in that description. But I think also to its credit, it doesn't, this is not a movie that's really interested in doing that, in my opinion, because it thinks it's fun to wink at the audience.
Right.
It does it just because it freaking works in
right.
the story it's trying to tell. And so having CeCe DeMille in there, he's in there as himself because it works. And this whole commentary about a silent movie star faded from glory and trying to make a comeback by casting a silent movie star that had faded from glory.
Right.
And wants to make it. It's just like, why, there are layers upon layers of this onion of a movie. And they all have such a strong root in reality that it is really, I think, Travis, tell me your thoughts on this.
Yeah.
To me, this is one of those first movies where David Lynch, our friend, starts becoming Lynchian.
Oh, sure.
This is pre-Lynch Lynch.
Absolutely.
This has got to be a big, fat influence because this is kind of a scary movie.
Yes.
Too.
It is.
Definitely disturbing on the physical, spiritual. It's a lot of themes that I think Lynch plays with. And so this, rather than just standing in kind of some... you know, like, well, that was a great movie they did back then, but, you know, people don't really make movies like that. I would argue that Lynch carries on the torch of the Sunset Boulevard to this day in spades.
Yeah, definitely more so than any other single filmmaker. And I mean, I believe, in fact, I'm pretty certain he's on the record. This is like, you know, one of the most influential movies in his, you know, film journey or whatever. I mean, you can see it, right? Like, they say the name Gordon Cole like 12 times in this movie. And he lifted the name
yes.
Gordon Cole into Twin Peaks directly. And there's just other things about it, too, that are like the ethereal weirdness that builds tension in this movie. It's like it's something a young David Lynch would watch and go, oh, I can make that way creepier.
Right.
I can make that way more under your skin. I can get more subversive with it, you know. So for sure, how does this movie play is like the question. Well, let's get into what's it saying, and we'll cover all of that. So the story, I think, Justin, if you'll oblige me this idea, it really if you just took the story on the surface level, it's like pure kind of noir, simple kind of paperback storytelling, right? You've got pretty yeah. small cast of characters, heavily emotionally driven, like I wouldn't say heroine, anti-heroine or something like that, and a man kind of under the gun, you know, under pressure. And all of that is like not unique, you know, like you can find a dozen movies from 3 years before this and 3 years after this that are pretty much the same idea as far as story goes. But what makes this really stand apart is that Lynchian sensibility, pre-Lynchian sensibility maybe, of like, this is a really unsettling movie, as you hinted at. And it's unsettling because they dig into what it's really saying beyond just the, oh, this person's affected by their situation, or oh, this relationship didn't work or did work. It's really more about like the human spirit and soul, and like how people can come undone when they've attached their identity to a career or something like that. But like the story starts with a classic noir voiceover where the guy's floating dead in the pool and he's telling you, well, here I am dead in the pool. I'm going to tell you how it happened, basically. Mm-hmm. And then we flash back and find our way there at the end. We have Joe Gillis, right, as our lead guy, who is a down on his luck, struggling writer in Hollywood. And we're going to talk a lot about Norma Desmond because she's obviously the most sort of enrapturing, weird part of this movie. But I got to say, I think the most compelling thing for it about me on the second watch, because I hadn't watched this before we watched it the first time, and this is now my brush up rewatch because someone stole the first episode. I don't know if we've mentioned that, listeners, but we got some stuff stolen. Anyway, the thing that jumped out to me even more this time as possibly the most compelling element is Joe being an aspiring writer. And the movie is saying, right, the art that he aspires to is impossible to accomplish within the system that is set up. I don't think he wants to write the baseball movie forever and ever. He wants to write the baseball movie so he can get the check, so he can pay for his car, so he can go write the good movie. And what happens when he meets with people that just gets, hey, can you cover me so that I can keep my car? You know, he meets with his agent. His agent says, no. A starving belly means you're going to be in front of the typewriter, right? And so there's this thread in here that's like, he has a struggle that is very different from Norma's, but the two stories being told are like what we've seen almost like in 42nd Street or whatever, where like you have this beginning of a career or potential beginning of a career and then the very tail end or like post-career. And all of that wrapped up into one to me is what makes this like just so meaty, you know, like there's so much here. Yes. Like you said, everything in this, it works. It starts with this guy, this portrayal by William Holden of this guy who is under immense pressure. What is your sort of immediate take on Joe as a guy?
Well, that he is, like you said, he's this down, trodden or down on his luck, I guess.
Yeah.
Guy who is he wants to make it for the reasons that people, I think a lot of people even today might aspire to come to Hollywood. Although I don't know, because even here in our friend Conan O'Brien talked to people that are, you know, our age or younger, and I've heard him, you know, quote not by name, but quote people saying, I want to do what you do. I want to be famous.
Yeah.
And he just looks at them and goes, "What? I don't know how to respond because I didn't get into this to be famous.
Right.
I love comedy." And so it obviously Gillis is not a guy that's trying to be a comedian, but he is just trying. I think he just wants to be a writer. He goes, "Look, I can write. I think I have a mind to create these characters." And so he goes to this system that supposedly is all about giving artists opportunity to write and to express themselves, to be creative and to have their voice heard. And instead he finds that voice, they go, yeah, that's what we want. We want some creative. We want someone with originality. Come on in here. And then as soon as you get in there, they go, okay, now we want you to play in this tiny area right here with a little shovel and a pickaxe. And he goes, how? I don't understand. And so that just becomes the constant battle, right? Which I think you see today, at least in America, still with artists of every kind and caliber. Yeah. It's like you have to, you know, on the indie scene, it's like, yeah, original, right? Or how about John Watts, right, Travis, the director that did that movie called Cop Car with Kevin Bacon,
right,
and those kids that stole, anyway, and then he went on to do Spider-Man movies for MCU.
Yeah.
And so I don't hold that against John Watts or against Marvel. I'm just saying that same kind of thing exists where the studio goes, oh, look at this guy. It's a little original. He's got some talent. Let's take him in and put him into the most formulaic money-making machine that we can and see what happens. And the result is often, I think some people just go along. This is just my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because, hey, the money's really good, right? Right. And there is a certain level of prestige just in saying, hey, I'm a director now. But my impression of Joe is that he is not nearly as like that. That's morally offensive to him, even though he does some things that we might morally question as the movie goes along. I think to him, that's kind of anathema, to use a big old word. It gets to the point later in the movie where he goes, you know what? I am just going to go back to Ohio and just work for my tiny newspaper.
Yep.
Because at least that's honest. At least I'm writing, and there's no glory, there's no prestige, but it's just me doing what I can do. And instead, this is all about what other people can get out of me.
Right.
And that's not why I didn't come here to be devoured. I came to give of myself, but if you're going to take it without me really giving permission, then I am out of here. So I think he comes across, even though he does have kind of a weird arc, weird in the sense of like he's not a guy that's, it's very clear, like, okay, he's starting here at ground zero, he's gonna roll that rock to the top of the hill and get over the other side. He doesn't have nearly as straight of a path.
He's not Jimmy Stewart. Yeah, not at all.
No, he's not. He's not. But I would disagree with even Wikipedia is one of those places that says this, and I think I've seen it on a couple other websites and publications too, where they call this movie a black comedy.
Yeah, I don't get that.
I would take real issue with that. And maybe that's because we're maybe weird, Travis. but you know, talking about like the Lynchian influence that this movie clearly exerts. I had forgotten about the Gordon Cole thing, but exactly. You don't have to look any further to make that argument, although there's plenty of other arguments that you can make about that.
Sure, sure.
But it, like, this movie is disturbing. It's not funny. Yeah. Like, this is an unsettling picture. And so I wonder if I can just get like a tiny bit philosophical and you can just tell me to shut up when we've gone too far. I think people's reaction to that discomfort a lot of the times, and I say this because I grew up in a family, at least my dad's side of the family is very much like this. If you don't know what to say or if something's uncomfortable, you laugh. Just laugh.
Yep, yep.
Right? How about when we went to see that movie, Jordan Peele's movie Us, in theaters, right? There is nothing funny about the like doppelgangers of people moaning in their weird language.
It's
disturbing. But I recall distinctly sitting in the theater with you and other people around us are cackling like we were watching an episode of South Park or something.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, I think labeling this as a black comedy, I think labeling movies in general is, can be kind of silly because they're generally a lot more complex than like, yeah, this is a drama, you know, like what does that mean? But even as specific as a title like Black Comedy is supposed to give us, I think in this case, that is way off the mark. And this is not, this is not that.
I didn't laugh one time, because there's nothing funny in this movie. There's some warm sort of delightful moments, when you get away from Norma, but I don't understand that classification either. Agreed on all points. I think the characters sort of instantly compelling as it's baked in, right? He starts out dead, he's under pressure, and so he needs to do something to better his situation. So what happens? He finds himself in the garage of this mansion, which is very decrepit, and this is something you're going to see, like, if you watch this movie with sort of a keen eye, that, like, the imagery in it is of a lot of, like, grand things that are sort of decaying. You know, you can... Mm-hmm. You can see that in the grounds of the property that Norma lives in. Norma herself, right, is like a grand thing that is now decaying before our eyes. We see the rats in the swimming pool. We see this sort of exorbitant pet in the monkey that is now dead under a blanket. So there's this idea of, you know, one age of filmmaking dying off and how it's sort of rotting in front of our eyes, and there's something to be mourned there. He ends up in her house. She is writing this ridiculously long epic movie that's going to be her comeback, and that's how she ropes him into their initial relationship, where he's going to punch up the script and edit it for her so she can make her big comeback. And then we keep dropping the Lynch name, but like the reason that is because this movie like starts at a very slow simmer and it just continues to like grow to a roaring boil, right? Like, there are things that happen all along the way with these two. As soon as you meet her, you realize she's not right, right? And there's sort of a creepy haunted house aesthetic. You've got Eric von Stroheim, who's like an awesome actor.
Right.
Another piece of meta information. He literally directed Gloria Swanson in silent films in the past. And so he almost took this role in order to have that mirroring make more sense. And then when you watch the last scene with that knowledge, it's even more impactful and insane that he's like calling action and telling her what the scene is. It's just bonkers. But the whole story really consists of like the normal world, which is just wrong. Like it's askew. She wants to be something she isn't anymore, and she's deluded, and she's like crazy wealthy, and so she's living in delusion. Eric von Stroheim's character, Max von Meyerling, a little close to his real name, is...
You got the von in there.
Yeah, exactly. He pities her and, supports her delusion, sends her fake fan mail, all this stuff. Just like you have normal world over here, and then you've got the real world where you don't see it a lot. And so you spend a lot of time where he gets sort of more under the clutches of her. He starts being dependent on her financially. He's sort of... reluctantly enjoying everything that comes with the wealth and the it's not really status because she's in her own bubble, but it's really like he's living in a crappy apartment. He's about to lose his car, and it's like, oh, you want to come stay in my mansion and I'll finance your life, buy you some nice clothes? Right. It'd be great. But these things start to happen, right? You see no locks on the doors, right? And in this one scene, the tension ratchets up threefold for me, Justin, because he gets out of this leaky room above the garage and they move him into the main house. He gets this huge, nice room, and two things happen. Max, the orderly, the butler guy or whatever, he says this was her husband's room. Actually, she had three husbands. And you're like, okay, I guess that's not totally crazy, but it's a little weird considering who she is. Two, no locks on the doors. And he says there are no locks on any doors in this house. And then he says, there have been some suicide attempts. And then he admits to writing the fake letters, like bam, 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 right, all in a row. So this just goes from weird and sort of like out there to like, okay, we have very much a reason to be unsettled by this situation. So what do you have to say, Justin, about like how the story builds tension? Because that is not normal noir tension building stuff to me.
No, it's not. And I think even, while there definitely is some noir aesthetics and some tropes, sort of, I guess, that might even be stretching a little bit. There's some noir influences that you could argue exist in this movie. Again, I think that's not as wrong of a description, in my opinion, as saying this is a black comedy, but it is it's a little wanting because when I think of noir, I think of something like The Maltese Falcon or, some detective is going to find something out and there's going to be murder along the way and, probably gunfire and a car chase and a 32 Ford or something. That's not this movie. It does have a voiceover, but this is a movie that the tension exists not because we fear our characters are necessarily in physical danger, which I think is why the kind of climax of this movie works so well, because it's not really even suspected that that could happen. I think it has a lot more to do with the integrity and the mental the mental faculties of people's perception of reality. That's really what's at stake. And if that sounds too like highfalutin or like I am, way off the reservation, I'd have you look at Norma as the case in point of that. And then just see what happens to Joe as he keeps living with Norma. He has this opportunity to really go with Nancy Olson's character, with Betty Schaefer.
Yes.
And he just goes, no, I can't do it. Ugh. And in one sense, we could go, okay, that's admirable. Good for you for, not jumping in on your best friend's girl, as they'd say then. But at the same point, it's also like, well, is he doing that because of that? Or because, like you said, this is a really comfortable, even though it's killing him, even though it's the antithesis of what the artist Joe Gillis would want to do, and even though it's just wrong on kind of every level, he's still doing it.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a case to be made that Max's character too, he is like, maybe he sees himself, best case scenario, as like the guardian of Norma.
Yeah.
But really, he's just, he's an enabler of this made up, really, ultimately what becomes a deadly kind of worldview.
Right.
And so I think the tension is built as you understand what's actually going on in Norma's house, as you actually understand the influence she once exerted and how that level of prestige and power allowed herself, not forever, for a very limited amount of time, actually, to have this immense amount of power and this gold swimming pool and, you know, this amazing old car. But even though that's been gone for 15 years or whatever, such is the wealth and the materialism she accumulated that she won't just roll over one day.
Right.
You know, it's this kind of sickness that has taken hold. And I think the tension to Travis is this. You keep peeling back the onion, I'm going to use onion again, of like
tasty.
The sickness. Yeah, it's a raw onion, so careful. Mm. This sickness of what it is to be obsessed with fame.
Yeah, sure.
And with fortune. And, you know, it can be great, and I think people aspire to be creative even in Hollywood today, as they did back then and when Hollywood was just born. Because that's a natural thing. If you're a creative person, you want to go express yourself. You want to, it may have very little, if nothing, to do with like, I want to be a millionaire. You could just say, I have a story to tell and I want to go tell that story. You know, will you people help me do that? But as you get involved in the system, you realize so much of this is not about that. It can just be about chasing your own vanity.
Sure, sure.
And so I think the tension that that I'm feeling when I watch this movie is feeling like, where, you know, here, I want Joe just to succeed as a writer, but he keeps getting, he's getting sucked down into this world that is everything but about that. It's about all the wrong things. And so the tension is, you know, is he going to make it out?
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, he does not.
Well, yeah, and the movie tells us that from moment one. So what's funny about that, though, is I kind of forget it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're watching it and he's clearly dead and it's like there's no question, but like it is nicely spun that doesn't linger in your mind throughout the whole movie because the rest of it's so kind of captivating. The thing you said a phrase that you said caught my ear, like once you realize what's happening in Norma's house. Let's just name a few of the things that happen with Norma, and then I want to make a quick point about her, which is we see crazy stuff, right? We see her just being commanding and controlling of him right off the bat as a stranger, which is really weird. We don't have to go into great length about it, but there's this party sequence where she throws a New Year's Eve party for no one. It's just him and her and this string quartet and Max. And that's when I think the voiceover even says, that's when I really realized what she really wanted, which was like, she wanted her to be his man. Like that's what she wanted, you know? And there's the really great sequence that you alluded to with Cecil B. DeMille playing himself on the set of a real life movie, just for the record, Samson and Delilah, that he was actually making when they shot this movie. all of that's nuts. Also, he did direct Gloria Swanson back in the day. So all of this checks out on the like reality front in a lot of ways. She has the spotlight moment, right, where she goes into the studio and she meets she meets this old grip who is up in the catwalk and it's like, oh, Norma, it's me. It's Hogeye. Oh, hello, Hogeye. Yeah. And then he turns the spotlight on her and people flock towards her and it's very like dreamy and weird. Like all of this stuff happens. She cuts her wrists. And then I want to make all this, like, I honestly don't want to spoil all these moments for you because I think you need to go watch this movie. But all of that is wrapped up into this really crazy, creepy, physically interesting portrayal. You know, a former silent film actress who is playing a former silent film actress who has lost her mind, essentially. And again, like, is so hungry for that fame. And yet, Justin, she's not just a monster. You know what I mean? She's not like the slasher villain. She's completely humanized and
she's still human.
And so the moment when, like, after the spotlight sequence, when she's leaving that set and DeMille walks her out And he knows this is not going to happen. She's not going to get her epic made. She's way past her prime. Nobody wants this anymore. She just says like, oh, I know it'll all work out. We'll make one picture and then we'll make another and another. And he just says like, okay, Norma, we'll see what we can do. It's just like, it hurts, you know.
You feel for her too, right?
Her, yeah, because she's physically and like emotionally and relationally monstrous, but like there's a person in there who has built her entire identity around fame is my life, and therefore if I can't have hope of that, then I might as well die. Like literally.
And don't you think there's something to be said there for there's a case to be made, I think, that Norma would have been able to acclimate and been able to actually kind of change with the times and maybe just do something else even besides movies if somebody had just been courteous enough to her to be honest.
Yeah.
And because no one, that's another problem in the Hollywood system, right? Like you can, I mean, that shouldn't be news to anybody, but in case it is, it's not a system that's known for being like straight up with people. If you go in and you try to pitch a script or you audition and people hate it, they're probably not going to tell you. They actually might tell you something that makes you think the exact opposite.
Oh, sure, sure.
And so instead of just having all these yes men or these people, even though it, and clearly by the time we get to that scene you're talking about with Cece DeMille, it's too late. Right. Yep. Like it's not even going to register if you try to be honest with her at that point. But how about 15 years before that? How about when Max had a chance as her husband, you know, to say
that,
like,
reveal is so good, dude. That reveal is so good.
Just to say like, Norma, this is like, I know it hurts. I'm bummed too, because I'm not a director anymore or whatever, but we got to do something else. And so I think the movie makes a really sharp critique too of just that, like, It doesn't do anybody any favors if we just lie to each other and like, yeah, we'll get this movie made and then we'll make it. Yeah, that sounds great. Let's go. Right. And then behind closed doors, you're like, F that person. It's not healthy.
Yeah.
And even though this is a completely fictional movie, it's not a fictional system. And some of these people are not fictional either. So I take that to be one of the most powerful lessons, although I don't think this movie is necessarily trying to teach us lessons. I think it does in spite of itself.
Yeah. It's speaking a lot of different truths at once and they all land, in my opinion. One of the ones that's definitely not primary, but it's just there. Like you can't ignore it is like women, right? In Hollywood specifically, there's no attempt in this movie to say like, what happens when male actors age out? Well, like, sorry guys, the fact is they don't as much, right? Like men can have, could and still.
They used to. I think that's a relatively new thing where they don't, but I would agree with you that women still face that problem in Hollywood today.
Well, and like you just think about Humphrey Bogart, right? Like in the same decade, like he is making the same kind of movies he was making 20 years ago and like flirting with the same kind of girls he was flirting with 20 years ago in a lot of film. I'm not trying to make blanket statements, but this movie specifically does say, right, that they make mention of just like offhand remarks, right, where she comes into that studio and someone says, oh, she must be about 100 years old. It's like, she's like 50 or 60. You know what I mean? Like, for Hollywood, you're dead basically, I guess, you know, if you're her. Yeah. And okay, let's skip to the other lily pad here. The next thing I want to touch on before we wrap up is the other plot in here, which doesn't really come along till later. The seeds are planted for Betty and Joe's relationship early on. This is so tied to our podcast, Justin, because when he brings that baseball script, he gives the guy the quick pitch, no pun intended, and she's there and she's read the script and she doesn't know he's who he is. And she says, this is garbage, you know? And, and then, he says, well, why don't you, you know, throw some dirt on my grave, lady, or something like that.
Yeah.
And she just says, I just think a story ought to say a little something, you know? Mm. So she is the piece of his story that is like pulling him into like you have ability, but tell a great story, say something, right? And so that's just really early on. It goes away for a long time. And then when they meet up again, that's the spark that ignites their like their attraction towards each other. It's not just pure like sexual animalistic. This is a attractive person. And you're an attractive person, and I feel, you know, anatomical mm-hmm. feelings for you. It's like they meet each other on the wavelength of like, no, we want to do something. We want to write something. Yeah. You know, she's bucking the system, trying to be a female writer in the 50s. He's just trying to be a writer that sells a script. And together they find this common ground. And I just want to say, this romance, like in this movie, between these two characters is one of the most like, first of all, it's like, I don't want to be crude, but like it is so steamy and like it captures the attraction like part of the story in a way that is so tactile and interesting and dynamic. Like the way that they become attracted to each other is so like different from the way you see it in other movies of the era or even now. And furthermore, it feels so like real. You know what I mean? It's not just like it is like sexy, like what real life feels like when it's that way. It is, I buy it. I totally buy that they would start out as friends. And then the way that they flirt is about this work that they both share. They have this friend in common who seems like a great guy. He even says he's one of the best guys I've ever known. You know, she's obviously going to be married to him because that creates story tension. But then when that goes away, when she says, I'm not in love with him anymore, he's in Arizona. He says, well, what happened? She says, you did. I don't know, man. Like in 9 out of 10 movies, that lands like a freaking wet towel. And I'm like, oh, get out of here. In this movie, I'm like, yes. Like, I don't know.
I think that's because this movie is real all over.
Yeah.
None of this is fake in some really kind of unnerving ways, as we've pointed out. I think it can't help but land effectually, because that seems to be the... If the writing team behind this and Mr. Wilder had any intent in telling this story, I have very little doubt that the chief intent behind this was, we are going to tell the truth.
Right.
And I think that is to their credit, and oddly enough, why it endures.
Yeah. And then the last couple things that happened, you already touched on one of them, but that scene between Nancy Olsen and William Holden in the mansion is, I think, just like... amazing. Like it's because you said it's not so simple. It is not so simple that he is doing it purely out of virtuous motivations, right? He's not just saying, you know, you don't want to be attached to me because of what I've done here. He is, I think that's there because you can see it on his face, right? He has that conversation where he's just like so blunt and cruel with her. And she says, like, I can't even look at you. You know, like, it's so, it hits so hard. But then what does he do? He goes upstairs and he starts packing his suitcase. He's out of there. He's like, this was the last straw for me. Like, this broke me morally. I need to just go to, was it Ohio or wherever he's going? Yeah. And so I think that whole exchange is so, it's complicated, and that's what makes it good. If it was simple and he just chose to be a bad dude at, that would kind of ruin the movie.
Right. No, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And then obviously we have the last sequence. Third act thoughts just overall. I mean, we've touched on the fact that he does die the staircase a little bit.
I think it succeeds because it breaks some rules because it's so committed to telling the truth.
Yeah.
If you hadn't known from the very first scene that Joe was dead, I think it would be one of the most, it would be like a Luke, I am your father kind of moment that Norma comes out of the house and actually shoots him in the back twice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like because knowing everything you know about her, you know, she's deranged in getting detached from reality and just not really with it. But I mean, she does have her friends for bridge over. So like, it's okay. Right. And so, you know, you've got Joe just holding on to, and then he says, I'm out of here. I can't hold, there's no hope here. There's nothing here, but I still find it surprising. It is still, that is just how good the story is that when she comes out and it kind of pans away from her and tilts to him and then bang, bang, and he falls in the pool. It's like, bam, I guess that just happened, you know? To me, the act succeeds because that scene succeeds. And they sell it just in kind of naked terms. Even another kind of minor thing, Travis, that is in the third act, as it's in every other part of the movie, but not exclusively so, is the score.
Oh, it's great.
It's just perfect.
Yeah.
It's not over the top. Nor movies as a genre, I think, if we can put them in a genre, mm-hmm. are really notorious from that era of just like the score. It may be sort of original, but it is loud and bombastic, and yeah. sometimes it drowns out the actors and the scenery and everything, and all you're hearing is horns.
It's overscored.
And it's
yep.
just a little too much.
If Franz Waxman did this score, and he has like several Oscar nominations. He did like The Bride of Frankenstein. He did Hitchcock's Rebecca, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So he's like a heavy hitter for this era. And yeah, that I agree. Like if this score wasn't big, it would be really weird. Like this movie is not The Third Man. It could not have, you know, what was that thing that they use in The Third Man?
The zither.
Yeah. That wouldn't work for this. This needs the orchestral score, and it only like uses it judiciously enough in the bigness and then the kind of small, kind of sweet sweeping. It has to sound and feel like a Hollywood movie, but not drown it out, like you said. And I think it's so supportive, like all the time, you know, of everything that's going on. The staircase, man. This sequence, my favorite part about the sequence is not the technicality, which is amazing. You know, like you watch the way that they shoot this. She comes out, and then there's all the reporters and whatever, and you have all this character stuff happening, but it's kind of just like you could watch it as a silent movie this moment, and it would be completely captivating. My favorite part about this scene is Eric von Stroheim. Like,
yes,
it's like, I don't know how he didn't win the Oscar because of this scene, because he is with the cops and she's just like madly brushing her. She's lost it. You know, this is after she shot him, and he just looks at her and he says like, it's time for your scene, time to go to set. And the cops are like, what are you talking about? You know? And he looks at her just briefly and the cops go, Oh sure. Yeah. Sounds good. And then he gets down and he starts playing director, and the look on his face as she's walking down the steps, and yes, there's cool frozen blocking that looks like a musical, and like all of that is amazing. Mm-hmm. But his face, man, that is what tells you this is not a freaking black comedy, right? Is he is like, this is the end, and I think I made it worse.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if we can reach into the meta sort of aspect of that too.
Yes.
It's just got to be bizarre to be him being filmed as he is pretending to film, even though you know he's really done that at some point in his life with that actress in probably a venue that was not too dissimilar. So I think I agree with you 100% that it's just phenomenal acting, but it's got to be so, it has to be that much more phenomenal because it is not, he has to imagine so little to sell that scene.
Right.
He has lived it.
He's feeling it. I mean, you got to imagine he's really feeling the like I'm watching this person descend this staircase and to her ultimate doom. And like, I don't know. There's just so much wrapped up in there, man. It's so good. It's so good. Let's call cut on this film of our own, Justin. And finish our thoughts in our final segment. Is it worth your time? Justin, start us off. Is it worth the people's time? If they don't think it is at this point, I don't know what we can do to convince them. But
yeah, here's a little twist, a little Shyamalan thing coming your way.
It sucks.
Yeah.
Not enough lasers.
One too many lacking helicarriers.
Yeah.
No. You know, I think this little anecdote, the story that actually happened when William Wilder screened this movie. For Mr. Louis Mayer himself of MGM, that mayor, Wilder screened it for MGM's chief and for some other folks. And when it finished, Louis Mayer got up and he went to Wilder and he said, "How could you do this to us?" to me, that says right there, the movie was a success. And Billy Wilder's response to how could you do this to us was getting up in Mr. Mayer's face and saying, go f*** yourself. And to me, that just says, there's one person that gets it in the room and one person that doesn't. Or at least right. one person that can admit what the problem is and want to do something about it. And one who admits there's a problem but doesn't see why we have to be honest.
Yeah.
And so for that reason alone, yeah, it's worth your time. If you want to just get a little insight, because these aren't new things, and it's not just in Hollywood, right? These are issues that people have struggled with: honesty, brokenness, infidelity, you know, whatever. Have your pick. It's in this movie. And yet this movie is able to kind of wrap so much up in good themes that I think we can't really be reminded of too much. And yet it also does it in a super cool, unique meta, as we've used that word to death in this episode, way, where you just get to, the more that you know, this is one of those movies, I think, where the more that you understand, actually, some background and some biographical data about the people involved in it, the more you will enjoy and appreciate this movie. So yes, it gets a recommendation from me. It's worth your time, time and time again. How about you, my friend?
The thing that strikes me most is that if you took away everything attached to reality, it still works. Like, it, you know what I mean? If all of those actual real life people who are analogs for themselves in the movie weren't, it still works. And when you just like factor those things in, this is a miracle movie. Like, the fact that this was made and that it got released and this cut of it is available for us to watch as such a scathing indictment of what is wrong with, you know, Hollywood and an American view on fame and what people are worth. Like, it's just remarkable, this movie. And the performances are all around killer. The storytelling, I don't know, there's something in here for everybody, I feel like. If you want a love story, it's there. It's a tragic love story, but it's there. If you want something creepy and subversive, it's there. If you want something that feels like noir, William Holden's character is, you know, kind of mono-emotional at times, you know, and that's kind of okay because it's stylistically correct. I really think that you can't go wrong watching this whenever you feel like it, because just having watched it a couple times, like, I can tell every time I watch it, there's going to be something new there. It certainly rings true today as it did then, maybe even more so just with hindsight. Yeah, this is the kind of movie that people who love movies ought to be watching. It's so, so good. It's satisfying on a twisty, turny suspense level. But when you just like let those themes sink in, man, like it'll get you thinking and feeling things that your average movie that may have made a lot more money at the box office, it may not. So worth your time. Watch it. It's great. All right, Justin. Well, the thieves didn't win this time. We won twice.
Well, we can say that once this is published. Until then, they may break in again. You never know.
Well, the good news is this was live, so every mistake we made is in the ether. Just kidding. Next week, we're going to record another non-live episode. It's on a film with our friend Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, is Jimmy coming back to the studio?
I'm coming back. It's Harvey.
Oh, he sounds a little older. Oh, there's Harvey.
There's a big rabbit. Jimmy Stewart, please join us. See you next week.
It's going
to
be great.
Bye.
Bye.
Let the movie speak. Speak.
Wait a minute. Haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I knew there was something wrong.
They're dead. They're finished. There was a time in this business when they had the eyes of the whole wide world.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet, and all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.